cybersecurity is about technology. But actually, if you look at cyber attacks, you will see that it's all about human psychology.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understandings from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, behaviorism, science, art, about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Garrick Jones. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today I'm here with my other co-author, Simon Brown.
Hi, everyone.
Today, we're delighted to be joined by Ganna Pogrebna. Hi, Ganna.
Hi, Garrick. Hi, Simon. Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Ganna is Professor of Behavioral Business Analytics and Data Science at the University of Sydney. She also leads the Behavioral Data Science Strand at the Alan Turing Institute, the National Centre of Excellence for AI and Data Science in London. Her work there is focused on hybrid modelling approaches between behavioural science and data science. It's a fascinating topic. Very much looking forward to our conversation, Ganna. You're working on incredibly interesting areas at the moment, spanning behavioural data science and social engineering, to AI and behaviour and practice, and human versus machine bias, to cybersecurity and cybercrime. And you have a new book coming out on the big bad bias, which is right in our sweet spot. It's hard to decide where to start from. Cybersecurity is a hot topic these days, as there have been some serious attacks in the past few months. You've done a lot of work on social engineering for cybersecurity. Could you share some stories of common or consistent tricks that are being played on people, for example?
Yeah, I think a lot of people believe that cyber attacks are all about technology. And especially, you know, considering that we're talking about curiosity, you know, I talked in preparation for my previous book, Navigating New Cyber Risk, I talked to practically all business people in London City, and many of them thought that, you know, cybersecurity is about technology. But actually, if you look at cyber attacks, you will see that it's all about human psychology. The code is very, very simple. So my 5-year-old son can write a code for the majority of these things. But in terms of the social side, the psychological side, it's kind of tricking people into doing something they otherwise wouldn't do, or making them not do something they're supposed to do. That's normally what cyber criminals are trying to do. And it could be from asking you to click on something to scanning a QR code. So currently we are all scanning QR codes all the time, and we treat them as something very secure. But you can actually put malware into a QR code very easily because it's the same website, right? It's like going to clicking on the wrong link in your email. Yeah, in terms of social engineering in general, I just wanted to say that, you know, a lot of people think that we are faced with some new attacks that are done by artificial intelligence, but that's actually not true. We looked at the history of cyber attacks, and what we see are exactly the same tricks as people played on us years ago. So the majority of things that we see have been invented in 1950s, 1970s, and so on. So essentially what we observe is mixtures, hybrids. So it's like fashion, you know. In fashion, a skirt, suit, trousers, they were invented long time ago. And now what we see is different citations, right? You are mixing the style of the 60s with the style of the 80s. And that's exactly what happens in cybercrime, because it's also a creative industry. So whoever can mix and match best would actually succeed.
Everyone innovates a little bit on the previous models. And my sense is that this is actually where it plays to people's natural curiosity in many of these instances. So if I think of some of the things I've seen recently where you get through the pandemic, everyone was receiving regular parcel updates and whatever, and you get your text message comes through of, you know, click on this. Oh, I'm curious what parcel that was. Does it play to our natural curiosity, some of these attacks, as a way to trick people in?
Yeah, so the most famous trick is, of course, urgency. You know, you basically are trying to create some urgency around, or if you don't click on it, your account is going to expire or something like this. During the pandemic, we saw a lot of examples where, you know, click on this and we'll tell you where to get the best vaccine or something like this. So definitely curiosity played a big role. But I also want to talk about the motivation of cybercriminals, because a lot of things that we do is we look at how cybercriminals work and what they're interested in. And this is how we are using algorithms to predict cybercriminal behavior. So instead of telling the companies, oh, you need to just think about robustness of your systems, we want to think about agility, right? So ideally, what you want to do is you want to invite cybercriminals in and make them give up because they cannot get to anything of value.
So what motivates them?
Yeah, so basically, you're trying to create this curiosity maze, right? When they're trying to get to something and they can't. And in the process, they give up all their important VPNs and we can actually trace them and eventually we can attribute the attack and catch them. But what I wanted to say is if you look at the history of cybercrime, initial cybercriminals, so people who were prosecuted initially, like Ian Murphy, for example, or Kevin Mitnick. So this is the guy who, I think, broke into FBI, the first ever attempt. So they actually were motivated by curiosity. They were kind of, can I do this, right? Wow. Is it something that I can do? So that was the motivation. But if you look at motivation now, the majority of people are interested, obviously, in cash. But there are exceptions. Right, there are exceptions. For example, we had just a few years back, we had this guy who was an 18-year-old teenager. His name is Raphael Gray, I think. His nickname is The Curador. So this guy basically just for the heck of it decided to steal some information from corporate, basically from large corporations. So he was trying to get credit card details. And he did it just to show how insecure our information is. You know, so how corporations cannot keep them safe. So that's kind of also this rebellious nature of, you know, someone who is engaged in cybercrime. But then, yeah, the majority of cybercrimes that we see are all about just, you know, getting some cash. And yeah, in terms of when we looked at cybercriminal speech and we try to understand the motivation, so number one motivation is money, number two is information, number three is changing the world. And obviously, if you are trying to change the world, you will go for different target compared to the person who's after money or information. And that's what makes it very interesting for us, because we get to see all shades of a cybercriminal activity and social engineering behind it.
You mentioned in passing there something I have to come back to, where you said the way you look to catch these criminals is by sort of trapping them in the curiosity maze. So tell us more on that. That sounds fascinating.
So basically, a lot of systems, you know, in companies, especially, you know, if we take, say, financial companies, we know that if you're going to make it more difficult for the cybercriminals to get in usual business, or say if you're, I don't know, McDonald's, right? If I make it very difficult for you to break in, then there is a high percent chance that you're going to give up. If I make the break-in time, I don't know, 20 hours longer, then probably the hacker will think, oh, you know, I don't really want to break into McDonald's. But if you're a bank,
they may be quite motivated.
You're not going to give up. And here the problem is that, of course, I'm not saying, well, let's just invite everybody in, right? That's not what I'm saying. Of course, you need your safeguards and you need to build a cybersecurity system that protects the organization. However, the thing is, if you are going to build a thicker wall, what you're doing, you're inviting a better cyber criminal. So it's basically, you can build the most secure house in the street, but if someone rings a bell, you probably will open the door, right? That's what's going to happen. And that's exactly what these guys are doing. So they are looking for kind of psychological tricks. But we can do the same, right? So there are also people, and they're also making mistakes. A few years back, what a cybersecurity specialist invented was the concept of smart honeypot. So what is smart honeypot? Smart honeypot is a machine that doesn't lead anywhere, but it basically allows us to trap the cyber criminal, right?
Fantastic.
What a lot of people do is they design these systems, you know, where to put the smart honeypots to attract cyber criminals to them. Then they basically go after those machines. They think that they can get to the money eventually, but they can't, right? And yeah, in the process, they give away a lot of useful information.
The smart honeypot. That two new words I've learned today, the curiosity maze and the smart honeypot. And of course, cyber criminals are just like us. They are motivated by interesting things like changing the world. Who knew? And money, of course, and just because it's there to be done. You've got a new book coming out called The Big Bad Bias, in which you talk about the periodic table of bias. And bias is very interesting to us because we are interested in understanding our bias so that we're not following curiously just a random set of assumptions or ideas or pleasure, but we want to learn. So we need to be aware of our biases, and we'll encourage people to check their biases all the time. But you define the periodic table of bias, and you define the bias in humans versus machine bias. Can you tell us a little bit more about those?
So my initial training was in decision theory. So I'm kind of like a very, very mathematical psychologist-ish economist. And then, yeah, my research became more and more data scientist. And I'm really interested in how humans and machines can cooperate and coexist in harmony, right? So a lot of things that I do are related to looking at how we can enhance, for example, human function with machines, and equally how we can spot biases in machines with, you know, human understanding. So humans and machines think in different ways, right? When we have data and we have knowledge about something. So say, let's just take a risk, very, very simple example. So when you know about a risk and you have data about it, historical data, then you can train a machine. The machine will learn about this risk, learn on data, and then you can formulate predictive models about when this risk is going to happen, right? So it could be a weather forecast, it could be an exchange rate, it could be anything, right? So any system can work like this. But when there is something that you don't know, when you're dealing in unknown unknowns category, then humans are actually a lot better than machines, because we have intuitions, basically experience. And in this case, you know, humans actually are operating in completely different system where they don't necessarily need data, but they just need an understanding that, you know, intuition that something is about to happen. And essentially, then the problem is, how do you combine these two systems, right? Because machines are trained on data. If this data is generated by humans, it could be affected by human psychology and then human biases. And the idea behind this particular book was very simple. So we just wanted to educate people that, you know, people have biases. And the machines have biases as well. So in that particular book, when we talk about human biases, and if we look at human bias, we now have over 200 different biases that are known in psychological literature. So this was meant to be a book for high school kids and kind of first year freshers in the university. We wanted to introduce different biases to the audience with a very simple example. There is a very simple story between two characters. And then most importantly, we wanted to talk about robustness, because a lot of times you hear people who are even Nobel Prize winners and they talk about some biases as if these biases occur all the time. To, you know, 100% of the time to all people. But that's not true, right? So some of them are very robust, but others are not. And so, yeah, we just want to talk about different biases and where they're found and are they robust or not. We also want to make this book accessible. So we have a really cool cartoonist who is working with us, and she's been very busy drawing illustrations for everything, for all the stories that we wrote. And yeah, this book is with Karen Renault. So Karen Renault is an engineer. And actually with Karen, we work a lot on human-machine interaction. Mm-hmm. For example, our recent project looks at reputation. If you interact with me and I lie to you, you probably are going to treat me differently, right? Next time around when you deal with me.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's not the same for machines.
Okay.
So it turns out that normally we don't trust machines as much as we trust people. So we naturally are not very trusting. However, if we do choose to trust, then it's like machines don't have reputation. So if machines are on and then you're saying, oh, I applied a small fix to it, then people are trusting this machine again and again and again. And this is exactly what we see in corporate world, right? Where people think that you can just apply a simple bug fix and the program will work, even if it didn't work before. Which amazes me, because, you know, if it was a human being and it lied to you once, it lied to you twice, you probably would think 10 times before dealing with them again.
How would you suggest we navigate that as humans, as we're seeing more and more being driven by AI with algorithms, and I guess from what you're saying, with inherent bias in those algorithms? So I guess one extreme is we ignore the advice coming from AI, but that would limit us from the value that it can provide. So how would you suggest we navigate through that world of recognizing that there's bias there, but taking the value that the algorithms can provide as well?
So I think the first thing to do is to recognize our dependency. So we have done a lot of tests with people, and we ask them, how is this industrial revolution different from previous ones? Like we lived through, this is the fourth industrial revolution we're living through, right? So AI is not something, well, it's something new, but it's not a different situation for us. We lived through industrial revolutions before. Automation, for example, at the beginning of the 20th century, right? People usually tell us that, oh, you know, if we wanted previously, we could switch machines off and, you know, fix the problem. But I actually realized this year that the movie Matrix is like 20 years old now. But if you watch the first series of Matrix. So, yeah, if we look at the first Matrix series, if you remember, there is at one point, there is a conversation between Neo and an elder in the last human city. And they look at machines, and the elder says, well, you know, have you ever thought what is going to happen if we shut down these machines? We will not have air. We will not have a lot of things. So we depend on these machines.
Great scene.
So basically, yeah, I think that there is a lot of like horror stories around working with machines and, you know, trust and privacy and trustworthiness and responsibility. And the thing is, we don't know what trust is. We don't know what responsibility is in this context. It's not scientifically defined. We need to work on these definitions, and there are a lot of, you know, people in law and ethics who are doing that. But I think the first step is to recognize the dependency. So, for example, if we didn't have machines working for us today, we wouldn't be able to have this podcast, right? We wouldn't be able to do this. So the first thing is we recognize that we're dependent. So once we recognize that we're dependent, then we need to understand what machines do best. And machines are very good at maximizing something or minimizing something or optimizing something, right? But they're not great at intuitive thinking. They're not great at kind of transferable skills. This is where the humans come in, right? And this is how we can contribute to each other's expertise.
You make the argument for us embracing machines, that they're here with us and that we are connected, and we are symbiotically connected in some kind of ecosystem. I remember there's so many things you make me think about, like Bruno Latour's work when he first started doing actor network theory and thinking, why don't we put machines on the same level as humans? Because they have a role to play in the things which absolutely transformed my thinking at the time. I'm also fascinated by the fact you've chosen to create a book, Big Bad Bias, which is also focused on young people, because the heart of critical thinking and being critical, understanding bias, is really something we're very passionate about. We talk about criticality in our book because we think young people especially need to learn skills that enable them to tell the difference between something that is a fact, something they can trust, fake news. I mean, how do we deal with that? What do you think about that future and the need to be able to distinguish the information that we are getting through these systems?
So I have one student who came to me and she said, I really want to work on fake news. And I said, I cannot help you here because I don't know what fake news is. Right? If I knew what it was, if I could scientifically define it, I think it kind of goes back to the work of John Dewey, right? So I think he had this very famous lecture that he gave in one of the big American universities where he basically said, okay, let's just read the newspapers from the French Revolution, right? And he read the Royalist news, and then he read the revolutionary, so the supporters of the revolution news, the common people sort of news. And these two newspapers, they basically portrayed the same event in two different ways, right? And you choose to believe what you choose to believe. So speaking about bias, we do have a confirmation bias when we talk about biases. And confirmation bias is basically you're looking for information that confirms your beliefs. And not only common people suffer from that, so like lay people or young people, like you were saying, Garrick, but researchers also do that, right? We have so many researchers who work all their life on one theory, right? They always pray to the same God. And there are very few people I know who, you know, kind of find that their model of the world doesn't work, and they openly say that, okay, I found that my model doesn't work anymore, so I'm going to write a new model now. And so I think this criticality that you're talking about, it's mostly about honesty, kind of when you're honest with yourself, right? If you're honest with yourself, then you're able to say, okay, I know that, you know, things didn't quite work here and I want to know why. And truth is more important to me than, you know, being right. Then it will work.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
I just have to comment on that. I mean, that's absolutely fascinating that you say this, the beginning of the journey of understanding criticality, understanding bias and your own bias, is to simply be honest with yourself and start with those levels of reflection. That, for me, that's fascinating and also very important because it gives us a starting point in when we're trying to teach us to become sensitive to bias and our own biases, how to be honest with ourselves. That's amazing. Can you say some more about that?
Yeah, so I can give you, let's just look at two examples that come to mind. So one example, so we have a guy in my field in decision theory, that, you know, my field that I initially studied, and that's Daniel Ellsberg. So Daniel Ellsberg is a very, very famous guy. He wrote some very famous theories in my field. He worked on ambiguity. So this is when you don't know the exact probability of something happening, but you know something about probability. So you know it's, for example, low probability of rain, right, in this time of the year. But you don't know the exact probability of rain every day. So he worked a lot on this, with these things. But what he is really famous for is that this was the guy who leaked the Pentagon Papers. And he was [S2] Wow. [S1] The most dangerous man in America. So, and so he went from being embedded in the system to changing his mind, right? He was a mathematician within this whole machine. And then he said, well, you know what? I'm going to be honest with myself. Something wrong happened here. And I think that that should not happen. Another guy that I can think of is Sakharov, right? So this is the guy who invented the water bomb. I'm not sure I'm saying it right. So military experts, please forgive me. But basically, yeah, he was working on developing basically weapons. And then he said, well, you know what? I really think that war is a bad thing. And then he spent all his life fighting against war, right? Hmm. And I think this is really cool. So the cool thing is just to be honest with yourself and actually say, okay, I know that whatever I've done so far probably is the wrong thing and I want to change it.
So essentially sort of applying curiosity into oneself of, yeah, what's actually going on here? Is this my own biases? Is this what I believe in? And constantly questioning. And maybe for many of us, it's not as dramatic as switching to decide that from developing weapons to actually war being a bad thing, or from researching ambiguity to releasing top secret government documents. But there's at a much smaller scale, I imagine that there's realizations that we can have of actually maybe, you know, what's driving us for certain things. If we truly question and truly reflect on ourselves, maybe actually there's biases at play there, confirmation bias being one of the key ones. And if we applied that critical lens, maybe it will help us with some realizations.
Yeah, another thing that is important here, I think, is to take responsibility, right? Whenever we choose to take responsibility for whatever we do, it makes it easier for us to analyze. If you know, for example, let's just take recycling, right? Recycling is not an optimal behavior. It's a socially beneficial behavior, but it's not optimal. It's optimal to pollute, right? And if I think, oh, you know what? I'm not going to think about it much. Yeah, I know that I shouldn't pollute, but you know, I'm going to still use plastic packaging. I'm going to use plastic straws. And I'm just not going to think about it. So I'm not really taking responsibility here. But if I take responsibility and I say, no, I want to know what plastic does to the ocean, right? I want to take the time and learn this. And I want to take responsibility for my actions when I use plastic. Then the change happens.
I love that. So asking questions, really thinking deeply, and then taking that responsibility into what actually are my actions going to have, and questioning that through into the longer term, I guess, in that example as well.
I've been struck by how much of this is about curiosity, and I hadn't expected that. I've been struck by how much of it is about asking the right questions, being self-reflective, critical, understanding yourself, being honest. It really is about curiosity. And how has your personal curiosity played in this incredible journey and led you down all these amazing routes?
So what my work is very, very mathematical, and it has a disadvantage that very few people understand what I do. Like, for example, my mom thinks I'm some sort of economist that doesn't know much about economics. And then I have friends who are economists, and they think that I'm some sort of data scientist, right? And but the good thing, so that's the bad thing, that it's difficult to explain to people. But the good thing is that because I work in a really mathematical field, my models could be applied to different types of applications. So I get to do a lot of interesting things. So like I get to do a little bit of cybersecurity. I do smart cities. I can do something in finance. I can do something about inclusion. So I can do a lot of different projects because my models have a lot of applications. And at one point, I remember my supervisor in the university, he called me into his office and said, Ghana, you do some amazing work and I really admire your work, but you need to focus on something. And I said, well, maybe I don't. Maybe it's my thing to actually, you know, apply my work to different fields and do that. So I guess my point is that sometimes people can tell you that you are probably too curious, but I'm not sure that you can be too curious. So I like to be seen as too curious because then I learn a lot of interesting things.
We'd agree with you, yeah. You talk about your models. That's also fascinating to me. How do you come to your models and how do you come to have trust in the models that underpin your work when you take them into these? Because for me, a model is like a language, and also a different discipline is like a different language. So you have a model that you trust and you can apply it like a lens to different systems. How do you come to your models and how do you come to trust them?
As a scientist, I never trust my model. That's why I test it. And I normally test it in the lab and I test it outside the lab. But, you know, talking about coming back to curiosity, you know, I think that it's also very important to talk to people outside your field when you're working on a model. And, you know, a lot of my work is, you know, data science, right? And like I said, I work in many different applications. So usually I work with a domain expert. So for example, if I want to write an algorithm for a hospital to optimize their surgery recess time, right? When you switch the teams and everything. So kind of it's a very operational type of project. So one way to do it is to just get into the hospital, get a bunch of data, and then, you know, write an algorithm. But it's never going to work because you don't understand the domain. So normally we get a domain expert. So this is normally someone who doesn't know anything about mathematics, but who spent, I don't know, 50 years in the hospital. And this person knows how hospitals operate. And then another thing, you know, sometimes you don't need a model. I can give you this example. And kind of this is one of my most favorite projects. So we were working on this project with an engineering company. And when we came to this engineering company, they had two machines. And basically, these machines were taking some measurements, and the engineers would go to an engineer at the beginning of the day, would go to a machine, get a bunch of measurements, and then he or she would make some decisions throughout the day. And basically, what was happening was there were two identical machines, but people were using one machine a lot more than the other. So there was a constant queue to one machine, and the other one was underused, and it was not optimal. So they invited my team and said, well, Ghana, can you write us an artificial intelligence model that would send people to different locations and we want to make it really optimal? And I said, well, but have you asked people why they go to this first machine, right? So, and that's like, again, coming back to your point about curiosity, you know, that's something that a curious person would do, right? Not a person who's thinking, how do I optimize something with an algorithm? So we came, you know, to this factory. So we went to the engineers and we spent a week talking to different people, asking them what was, you know, why they use that machine. And we figured out that it was because they trusted that machine more. So they somehow thought that one machine was more accurate than the other.
Fascinating.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then the next thing that they did, they came to the CEO and said, well, it's my project, right? I can do whatever I want, right? And he said, yes, sure. So I said, well, here's what I want to do. I want to come at midnight and I want to switch the machines. And he said, okay, well, these are huge machines. They're like, you know. So yeah, so we came. Very few people knew about it. Basically, it was my team and two more people from management. And we moved these machines. We switched them. And over the course of the next week, people started to queue to their own machine, right? So because we changed the location. And we filmed it. And basically, we just all we did at the end of this project, we showed people the film. And we said, it's basically in your brain. Like, it's not that, you know, this machine is more accurate. It's not more accurate because we switched them and you didn't even see the difference. And now they don't have the problem. So the machines are actually used at random. You know, and there is no preference and there is no backlog.
Visual narrative media as feedback. Brilliant.
Yeah, so, but it's actually, you know, it's actually about, you know, asking people what is the reason, right? What is the reason for this problem? And then basically trying to find a simple solution. So sometimes you don't need an algorithm. And yeah, you know, I always try to find a simple solution first. And then if algorithm is the best thing that can solve it, then we write an algorithm. But then again, we question algorithms a lot. And like I said, talking to a different person from a different field really helps. So another example I can give you is very quick. So we were trying to write an algorithm that would help homeless people in London. There is a big problem with homelessness in London. And when there are sub-zero temperatures, you really want to help people, right? So you want to tell shelters where to go out to help these people. So with my friend, we thought, great, we're going to get a bunch of pictures of homeless people. We will write a recognition algorithm that will recognize, using cameras and sensors, will recognize people in the street. And then we talked to an ethicist, and she said, have you thought how law enforcement might use your algorithm? And we were like, no, but that's a good point. And we would never have, because like you are thinking about this benign goal, right? But then you start thinking how, in principle, it could be misused. And I think part of, writing responsible algorithms is thinking what could go wrong, right? What harm can it potentially bring, right? Can it harm somebody?
I have to ask you about friendly AI very quickly. What's your view on friendly AI and how the coding of AI can ensure that we don't optimize humans out of the equation?
So first of all, a lot of people, when we say AI, they imagine the Terminator, right? We are very far from Terminator. So we don't have machines that can determine their own purpose, right? Normally, you determine the purpose, and the machines, they just, sometimes they have some ability to understand how to get to this from point A to point B, right? So for example, when you have self-driving cars, or, I have this vacuum cleaner that learns the size of my room and it can go around the room in the most optimal way. So I think, humans being out of the equation, we are far away from that in terms of practically. But I think there is more sort of philosophical question here, right? So how do we make sure that once the technology is there, then the humans are embedded in the system? And I think there is no easy answer to this, but obviously, again, if we actually try to understand what the machine does, right, then so one solution is, and this is something that my team works on and I work on, is try to write algorithms that are explainable to humans. And for example, if we take standard machine learning algorithm like convolutional neural network, you don't know what happens inside the algorithm. It picks an optimal answer and you don't know how. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to change that. So we are mixing behavioral science models with data science models to be able to say, okay, this is how the machine picks, right? And then when you look at it, you understand what's going on. And once you understand what's going on, then you can change it. You can fix it. So you no longer need, like one of my colleagues says, previously we had machines where we just could fix a bug, right? They were brute force machines. And now we have these machines that have use machine learning, convolutional neural networks, and you almost like a psychiatrist, need a psychiatrist for a machine. So you don't need a psychiatrist for a machine, right? If you understand how it thinks. And that's where we're trying to get at. So, we're trying to write these models that, are explainable to humans and we understand what's going on.
So it's been a fascinating conversation. We've covered from cybersecurity and the tools that cyber criminals use around urgency and playing into our curiosity. You described the something I'd never heard of before, the curiosity maze, of how we can potentially catch cyber criminals by letting them into the curiosity maze and letting them run around and reveal things about themselves that allow us to catch them, and using the smart honeypot as well, another new concept not heard of. Around the motivation for cyber criminals of being money, information, and changing the world. Then delving into your specialty around humans and machines and how we can coexist and trust for machines and how they can enhance us, our human functions. But we need to be very aware of their bias, and unfortunately, our human biases get incorporated into our algorithms as well. It talks about confirmation bias and the importance of criticality, and some great stories around people who have moved from ambiguity to leaking Pentagon papers, or from creating weapons into realizing what a bad thing war is and doing something around it. Our own behaviors as it relates to recycling, and how actually if we think about taking responsibility, that can be a valuable way for us to self-reflect and actually look into why we do things and create our self-awareness. And then talked a little bit about your models and how those get created, the importance of recognizing where there may be unintended consequences from creating models, how they may be used for things that we don't want, and making sure that we're checking that. And then reassuringly talking about friendly AI, that we're still a long way from the Terminator movies, and certainly looking at how hard it is for my robot vacuum cleaner to get back to where it started sometimes. It's reassuring that, yeah, maybe machines aren't quite going to take over the world quite yet anyway. So massive amount that we covered there. If there was one thing that you had for our listeners to take away from all of that, what would be sort of your most important summary from all of those things?
Yeah, I think our conversation shows that curiosity has mysterious ways, and it can tell you on paths that you do not expect. I just want to say to people, kind of to reiterate what I already said, try to go out of your box and talk to people who are not in your field, and you will find a lot of interesting things, because you are always kind of locked within your box and within your methods. But these people think outside the box, and they will give you ideas that you don't have.
Gana, thank you so much. It's absolutely wonderful to talk with you. So much depth and so much academic detail. You're a mathematician, but you appeal to our humanity fundamentally. And I myself have really been struck by how we can teach bias by an awareness of bias by starting out asking people to reflect on themselves and be honest with themselves. For me, that was been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us, Gana.
Thanks a lot. It was great to be here. And we should do it again. It was really fun. Thanks a lot. Thank you, Garrick. Thank you, Simon. And thanks to everyone who listens to this wonderful podcast. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We are curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what have you learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts, having a curious conversation. Join today, hashtag Curious Advantage. The Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your copy now to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast.
The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon.
Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty, and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.